Carl Medeiros. He's an Arab American Muslim Christian guy who is involved with relations between those kinds of people. He lived in Lebanon for 12 years. And I don't know exactly when this was, but a little while back, he was in the United States in a place called Boulder, Colorado. And he and a friend had a camera crew, and they did a random survey of 50 people in this mall, asking them basically their opinions, their feelings on the state of American religion and Christianity. And so the first question that he asked these 50 people was, what are your feelings about Christianity? So out of 50 people, how many do you think were positive about Christianity?
Five.
Any other guesses?
Ten.
Zero.
Get out.
100% of the people that he surveyed were negative about Christianity. It even says that many of them used expletives to express their negativity, and they had to actually bleep out Christian Hammer Group, had to bleep out the expletives in the little film that they were making. How many people do you think had positive views of Christ? So that was the question about Christianity. Then they asked them, what are your views on Christ, on Jesus of Nazareth? How many of them do you think were positive about Christ? Maybe talk to your neighbor for 10 seconds and tell them what you think, and then I'll get you to it. Sure.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, who can I pick on here? Sonia, what do you think?
My husband thinks 7 to 15.
7 to 15.
I came in higher.
And what was your guess?
30.
30. Okay. How about you, Warren? You can also answer for your wife if you don't want to ask yourself. As Sonia did.
10?
10, yeah. Did you raise your hand, Jennifer? You know the answer, so yes.
48.
Esther.
I think I'm 60 or 80.
You think 60 or 80 people out of a 50 person survey?
Percent.
Oh, percent. Yes. 60 or 80%, yes.
Jesus
was multiplying survey responses. How about you, Bryn?
45.
50 out of 50 were positive about Jesus.
Wow.
So 100% negative about Christianity and 100% positive about Jesus. What do you make of those results? What counts for that?
The church is broken.
The church is broken. Any other thoughts or ideas?
Did they give a definition of Christianity?
They just asked off the cuff, what is your initial, they didn't give much of a, to my knowledge, much of an explanation.
If you look at American, state Christianity,
yeah.
It's
just
the American
state. Yeah, so you're thinking because, and that's a largely negative thing that most people think.
Unless you were in something.
Yes. Well, this is Colorado, so that's not like the deep south or anything.
I think it's just something about our ability to go
and spread the truth. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Was this survey done before or after the legalization of marijuana?
That's a good question. That I do not know. You think that when marijuana was legalized, all of a sudden people would love the church more, or?
I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what they would love more, actually? Yeah.
I was reading the latest Philip Yancey, where he talks, it's called Vanishing Grace, and it's kind of about this question, but one of the things he said was that in the last generation, particularly the American church, has moved from grassroots, serve your neighbor, community-minded things, to political, enforce morality at the highest levels.
Right. So it's more systemic or something.
Becoming more systemic, and that whether or not those are related, that there's also been a huge shift in how Christianity is perceived as we try to become more systemic or informing other communities. to do.
Yeah. Any other thoughts about those two results? Are you shocked? Yeah. So, obviously in the Western world now, in the cultural landscape of the West, we're living in a time where there seems to be a vast chasm between Jesus and how people feel about him and his people, or the business of faith that surrounds him, the community of Christians, the church, etc. There's a big gap between them. And the question is, how do we narrow that gap? How do we make those two things one, so that people not only love Jesus because of his moral teaching, or because he was a good person, or a model human being, or even because he was God, but they want to associate themselves in this community of faith? It's a pretty profound question. So we're actually beginning a new series that's going to focus on the stories and the parables of Christ with a view to trying to narrow this gap. So the idea is that as we rediscover who Jesus is through his stories, through his life, through his parables, and recapture some of the awe and wonder of who he is, and specifically to understand how he answered some of the questions of his own day, the concerns, the people that he addressed of his own day, that might in some way equip us to do the same in our time. So if we can see how Jesus answered the questions of his day, and how he related to people in his day, and what grabbed a hold of their hearts so much, maybe we would know a little bit more how to do that ourselves. Does that make sense? So, in Romans chapter 10, and this is not the passage for the morning, but I just want to contextualize what we're going to do a little bit. So in Romans chapter 10, verses 14 to 15, Paul says this: "How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news." So the idea here is that others enjoying relationship with God depends on somebody preaching to them. So it begs the question, especially considering this cultural landscape that we're in, how do we do that? And what do we say? What is our approach to trying to share or to preach the good news of Jesus to this world so they can enjoy all the faith and hope and love, peace and joy that we enjoy? And you may, if you want to know more about this, I would say you ask Bryn about this, because he probably knows much more about it than I do. I'm putting him on the spot here. But basically, there's this kind of like the air that we're breathing. Culture is the air that we breathe. Whether we like it or not, we're always affected by culture, right? So one of the predominant things is this idea that the way things were in times past is not the way things are. Some people call these different shifts, they can kind of group them within this idea called postmodernism. And it's not, I don't want to be all lectury about what that is. You can talk to Bryn about that. But I do want to mention three things that really affect the way that we talk about and preach the gospel now that were not necessarily as prevalent an issue back in the day. So one of them is the idea of truth. So people these days are not as ready to believe that truth is as you tell it to them. They might actually be suspicious of that and think that it's a power play, that you're actually trying to limit or exclusivize what you're saying. And so who do you think you are? What right do you have to tell me what to believe? That seems like you're trying to wield some power over me. That was not the case in times past, where people would have very willingly listened to what you had to say, especially about God and religion, and maybe take it a little bit more palatably. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is guilt. You notice that when many of us were younger, a lot of the Christian emphasis in evangelism and even on street outreach, and I'll tell you a funny story about this in a moment, was on people's consciousness of guilt. If only people could recognize that they were guilty and they didn't have a way to deal with that guilt, well then Jesus could sort of fit in that box. Does that make sense? people had a sense of guilt and they just needed an answer to that guilt. Well, it's not the same thing now. People don't feel a sense of guilt. If you walked up to the average person in the mall and say, hey, do you feel guilty for all the things you've done in your life? They probably would say no. I've lived a good life, I'm doing what I can, and actually I don't want to live a life of shame. Like, what I've done has brought me to where I am now, so I don't have any regrets or guilt. So how can you put Jesus into that whole guilt puzzle when they don't have a consciousness of guilt? And the third thing is meaning. So, you know, people used to believe that books and words and texts had authority to spread meaning. But now people are very suspicious about that. You think the Bible's true? Who gives you the right to say that that book is authoritative and should tell me the meaning of my life? Furthermore, who says that your interpretation of that book is right? That might be true for you, but that's not true for me. You know, like, these days people want to experience truth for themselves. They don't just want it handed down on a plate to them so that they can believe it. They want to know that it's true for themselves. They're not trusting authority figures or even authority texts like the Bible to tell them what's true about the world. So these three things make it a little interesting about how we preach. If we can't talk about guilt in the same way and an answer for that guilt, if we can't say the Bible says so, and if we can't, what was the third one? Yeah, truth and meaning. If people aren't as willing to believe that it's true, just because the Bible says so, or just because people from thousands of years have believed this way, it's a bit of a problem. So let's look at John chapter 8, verses 1 to 11. And this is just going to be a starter for this series. It's one of my favorite stories in the whole of the Bible. And we're going to look at it with a lens to understand who was Jesus, what is it that people might love about him, and then what is it that people might hate about people of the church or religious people? This story kind of, sorry?
You can say us.
What might people hate about us? Yeah. Maybe I will tell that story that I said I would tell you, that embarrassing story. So just to show you the difference between, you know, things before and things now. So when I was in my youth group, a few of us were going on a mission trip to Thailand. And so we were preparing for all this stuff. We were going to teach English at a little school, etc. And so one of the things we had to do was prepare a drama, an evangelistic drama to win the lost for Christ. Okay? Now, you can imagine, some of you are laughing, so you probably know what's coming. But you can imagine somebody somewhere thought, in a room, okay, we need to win people to Christ, we're going to use drama, but what do I write in this drama? What do you think you might write if you wanted to have people believe in Christ and have it acted out in a drama? What would the story be? Anyone want to guess? You probably know this.
Lots of brokenness and sin and like anguish and
yeah.
Jesus and kisses.
Yeah, totally. So there was exactly that. So in the story, there was this helplessly lost character who was navigating through all these terrible things. You know, the party scene, the drug scene, the sex scene, and you know what? Guess who had to play the lust portion of the drama? That was me. And somehow they decided that they wanted me to play it as a woman, too. So not only was I the lust character, I was a woman who was supposed to seduce this wandering, soulless man. And not only that, they, you know, really wanting to emphasize the power of the gospel, here they are putting eye makeup on me and like slinky clothes, and it's mortifying, but I had to do it because I wanted people to get saved. So here I decided in my little teenage heart that I was going to be the most godly lust person ever there was, filled with the Spirit, you know, and everything. But it was an embarrassing thing at the time. But now when I think about us doing that as a church, I think, can we go to Portage Place and act out that drama and tell that story? It seems almost laughable. And it's not because Jesus doesn't heal brokenness sexually with drugs and addiction and all that stuff. It's just that the story seems different now because the audience is different. And you have to take into account your audience when you tell a story. Does that make sense? So back in the day, with these very vivid dramas about the person who just wanders through all this stuff that most people would think is awesome now, back then it seemed to have some kind of motivating power to people believing. Whereas now, I don't think I would endorse a drama like that because I don't think that actually portrays the gospel as well as it should. So that's an interesting thing, and that drama I hope vividly illustrates some of what we're going to talk about this morning. But anyway, John chapter 8, verse 1 to 11. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn he appeared again at the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." I think this story is so brilliant and so wonderful. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to frame the story in four different ways. To talk about priorities, to talk about relationship, law, and sin. And to understand those different kind of categories, I want to look at those four things from the perspective of Christ, how he is amongst those things, and then the perspective of the religious teachers and the Pharisees. And we'll see if we can't understand why people might love or like Jesus so much, and why people might not like or love religious people, or Christianity, as it's portrayed. Does that sound okay? Yeah. It would be amazing if someone actually once said, "No, that sounds terrible, what would I do?" I guess we sort of bank on you just kind of silently nodding and accepting everything that we want to say. Interesting. I won't take advantage of that. Thank you so much for listening. Anyway, so the first thing is relationship. So Jesus' presence, there's something about his personality and character that has this inherent magnetism, something that has this inherent power to attract. And you can see this in right in the beginning, in verse 2, where it says, all the people gathered around him. All the people gathered around him. And many of us here in this room, we, although we might not be able to articulate it and put it into words, we feel that about Jesus and about God. There's something about him that pulls us close to him. I remember when I was a kid, even before I could articulate some of the reasons why I might believe, I had a very strong burning desire to believe, a very strong desire to get baptized and to take communion, right from a young age. And I don't know, I was talking to Jennifer about this, like I don't know why that was. There was just something about him that pulled me towards him. And right here in the beginning of the story, we see that Jesus is sitting and there's all these people just circling him, gathered around him. The teachers and the Pharisees, though, it's very interesting that the only person who's not one of them has been forcibly dragged to be amongst their number. She is an unwilling participant. Jesus has this magnetism, and these people are pulling someone to be with them amongst their number. And the word in the Greek here is very telling. In verse 3 where it says they brought the woman, the word brought there in the Greek actually means to lead by laying a hold of, to bring to a destination as you do with an animal. Does that sound like something that people would want to be part of? Somebody forcibly leading you to a destination like one would lead an animal. We don't see Jesus like that. People are just drawn to him. Priorities. Now, I love that this two-word phrase, at dawn. Jesus gathered at the temple at dawn. There was something inside of him that was excited to live out the mission. There was something that motivated his heart to get up early and do it. And he was right there preaching and living a life of service in order that the words of life might fill up other people. That was his priority, and he was committed to that priority. Now, the teachers and the Pharisees at the time, you could imagine them to be like the paparazzi or like the tabloid press. It was like they were sitting at the door of scandal. Now, when I read this story so many times, and I read it obviously a lot of times in preparation for this morning, and it doesn't actually say when this woman was caught. When I used to read this story, I used to think that somehow they stumbled or broke into the house and seen all this happening and forcibly dragged her out and brought her immediately to Jesus. There was something about it that felt very immediate, right? Not like this happened 20 years ago, but this happened so recently. There's something very visceral and vivid about the whole scene unfolding. Well, a lot of scholars say that it's most likely that it happened the night before. And so right at the earliest moment, they drag this woman right to Jesus at the earliest possible time. So here's Jesus at the earliest possible time, spending his life and his words building up and encouraging and strengthening people. Meanwhile, the teachers and the Pharisees, at the earliest possible, at the crack of dawn, they're bringing this woman, who they've caught in the act somehow, right to Jesus. It's such a difference in priority, isn't it? You could say that their ears perked up and were burning with the rattle of the tattletale. They were so ready and so excited to hear bad news about people. Law. Now, the teachers and the Pharisees, obviously, they're experts in the law, aren't they? They quote the law of Moses. But what they emphasize is its punishment and condemnation. In verse 5, the law of Moses commands us to stone such women. The law also talked about a Lord who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, rich in love, who separates sin as far as the east and the west. Why is it that they're glasses, as it were, are so focused on the punishment and condemnation of the law? Another thing about it is it's selective in application. In Leviticus 20, verse 10, this is the actual law that they're quoting. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. So here's this focus on punishment and condemnation, but only selectively applied to the woman. Where's the man? If they were real students of the law, and they were really wanting to follow the very, dot every I and cross every T of the law, they would have brought both the man and the woman. Maybe he ran off or something. We don't know. But they don't even mention the man. Selective application of the law. And we can see kind of some male chauvinism and patriarchy at work here. Even in the phrase, such women should be stoned. And obviously they use this law for power and entrapment. They're actually not super concerned about the law because they want to be godly. They're using it as a way to trap Jesus, is what it says. In verse 6, they were using the question about the law as a trap to have a basis for accusing him. So if Jesus agrees, yes, that's true, that's what the law says, it sort of shows this inconsistency with his own message of forgiveness and mercy and love of the sinner, and diminishes his spiritual authority as a result. But if he disagrees and says, no, don't do that, then he shows himself to be at odds with the law, which also diminishes his spiritual authority. So they're really thinking, we're going to diminish this guy's spiritual authority so that we can exercise our spiritual authority and power. We want it. We don't want to share it with this guy. And that's how they use the law. Now Jesus, obviously being God, is familiar with the law, right? He's its author and its origin. And listen to this verse. I thought this was so telling because we see Jesus' fingers at work in the story. I wonder if this was in Jesus' mind as they bring to him this woman and start quoting the law of Moses to him. Exodus 31:18. When the Lord finished speaking to Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave him the two tablets of the covenant law, the tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God. Isn't that ironic? They're bringing to Jesus, to God, whose fingers inscribe the law, a woman that they think they understand the application of the law about. It's very ironic. And Jesus obviously knows the scriptures. Exodus 20:14 says, "You shall not commit adultery." That was something that his finger inscribed on a tablet of stone and gave to Moses. Sin and sinners. Now the teachers and the Pharisees, and I think sometimes us, if we're honest, believed that there was a vast divide between this woman, a sinner, and themselves, the righteous. They felt they were closer and nearer to God. They felt they were in, and she was out. A strong sense of us and them in terms of righteousness and sin, godliness and worldliness. Oh man, they so knew who she was, and they so knew by implication who they were. They seem to equate sinners solely with their sin. And all that they can see about this woman is that she's an adulterer. That's all she is, and so therefore, God's only response ought to be solely in relation to that fact. All she is an adulterer, and all God will do in response is something negative to punish and condemn adultery. There's this song that I love by an artist, and there's this very wonderful turn of phrase that she has where she's singing this song about a big superstar. And there's this line in the song where it says, "You're more than a superstar." I love that line because oftentimes when we think of the biggest thing that is visible, the most obvious thing about a person, we think that is who they are. You're more than a superstar. In this song, it's like, no, what you see and what's shining on the stage as brightly and as visibly and as obviously to human beings is not the whole story. You're more than a superstar. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law did not see that she was more than a superstar adulterer, let's say. That's all that they could see. That's the only lens that they had on this woman. They equated her solely with her sin. And not only that, it gets worse. They put her in the spotlight and highlight her sin in front of everybody. You could say that they're masters of shame and humiliation. Physically, in verse 3 it says, they make her stand in front of the group. I don't know if you've ever been forced to stand in front of a group. I mean, it's one thing to get recognized and celebrated in front of a group. But can you imagine your most secret failures, your most secret shame and embarrassment being paraded in front of a group for all to see? Imagine if I know some of you pretty well. Imagine if I propped you right in front of here and told the whole of this little community here your deepest, darkest secrets that you've told me. It would be brutal. And not only do they physically parade her, verbally, they also put her deepest failures and sins right out there for everybody to see. Publicly announcing her secret failures. This woman was caught in the act of adultery, and the law of Moses says we should stone her. brutal. So brutal. Has anyone ever experienced something brutal like that? Or seen something brutal like that in the church? Did you want to say what that was?
Someone excommunicated from the church for getting divorced.
Someone excommunicated from the church for getting divorced, yeah. When their husband had cheated on them. And was that sort of announced publicly, or it was announced publicly? Oh, it makes my spine tingle in a bad way to think of that. You can understand here why 50 out of 50 might think negatively of the church and of Christians if they parade people's failures and embarrassments in front of everyone. Masters of shame and humiliation. Oh man, that is so, I hope to God we are not like that. I think our community is, thankfully, quite different than that. But what about even in the privacy of our hearts? You know, do we sort of rejoice when we hear the gossip and the tabloid kind of stuff about other people in our community? Is that kind of what we celebrate and highlight? Or is it something else? Is it something more Christ-like? I know for myself, sometimes I have to remind myself not to do that. There's something about the bad, about the negative, that makes you feel kind of alive, doesn't it? There's something juicy about juice. It's why the paparazzi probably are lying in the gutter trying to take people's pictures. This is like exciting stuff. And you know, it can seep into our faith too. Sometimes we can call that gossip. Jesus, however, when it came to sin and sinners, he came to erode the gap between sinners and the righteous. You think you're righteous? He says. Think again. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It's this idea of sola gratia, that only by grace do any of us have any standing whatsoever. Solely grace. Solely grace. Are we justified because of anything else but the blood of Jesus? No. No. And in that moment, when Jesus finally interacts, by the way, I love that, you know, they bring, you can imagine that there's this hustling, bustling crowd, and they bring this woman, and they're yelling and screaming, and it's kind of an angry mob mentality. And they're demanding an answer from Jesus. Tell us what you say. And I love what he does. He's already sitting down. But it says that he bends over and he scribbles something in the dust. Now, lots of speculation has gone into what he scribbles. That's not the point, I think, of the story. But the point is silence. Pope John II said that this silence invites the people who are clamoring for a result into self-reflection. The only voice they are hearing is their own voice of their own accusations. That's the only thing that's ringing in that moment. And silence, how amazing. You know, here, again, it's priorities. These people, they're demanding answers now. They're talking. They're filling up the space with words. And here we see the Son of God in silence, scribbling in the dust like some kind of child, doodling in the sand. Not giving them an answer immediately, not filling up the space with words and expertise and knowledge about the law. Although he is the Son of God, who fingered and authored the law with his own hands, so to speak. I love that silence. Sometimes we're so quick to judge and so quick to analyze, evaluate, and put our stamp of approval or disapproval on things. I was so challenged by this silence. It happens twice in the story, where he bends down and doodles in the sand. And when he stands up, or at least straightens up, it says, we don't know if he stood, but he straightens up, this is what he says. Any of you who is without sin, cast the first stone. when we think of the things in our lives that we feel so sure God disapproves of. It's even written in His law. We're ready to pick up a stone and administer the punishment, administer the justice of God, administer the truth of God, administer His law to this God-forsaken world. Jesus is saying, you see that stone? You might need to look in the mirror to use it. If you really want to use a stone. And so what he does is he reorients the zeal of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law about sin. He reorients it from focusing on this woman to focusing on themselves and their own self-righteousness. By saying, any of you without sin are welcome to throw stones at this woman. It's fantastic logic, but it cuts right to the heart. It was like their hearts were made of stone, and somehow Jesus' words cut through that heart, break something in them, their own stubbornness and hard-heartedness. Wouldn't it be amazing if we as Christians had an amazing reputation for not just calling out people in the world for their sins and lawlessness, but we were passionately self-reflective about our own sin. And we looked at ourselves and thought, oh, God have mercy, I'm a sinner. I think what he was kind of saying was, are any of you without sin? And if you are not without sin, don't you deserve punishment? And if you're sinners who deserve punishment, aren't you like the woman? In fact, aren't you the woman who you thought you were so different from when you dragged her before me? Are you an adulterer? And have I just caught you in the act? It's amazing that the scriptures often talk about adultery as sin, right? When God says to his people, you have been adulterers with me, you've worshipped other gods, your hearts have been far from me. I wonder if in that moment, all of those scriptures came bubbling to the surface of the consciousness of these people, and they thought, oh my goodness, we are an adulterous people. We don't know, we can only speculate what they might have thought. Your hearts are far from me, you teachers of the law and Pharisees. And the other part of this moment, which I absolutely love, is Jesus establishes himself as the only one who can rightfully administer judgment and punishment. He is the only one in that circle who is without sin. Therefore, he's the only one who could stone her. It's so profound. He's at once demolishing the hypocrisy and self-righteousness of these people and elevating his own authority as God who has the right to judge. And it's a fascinating moment where one by one, from oldest to youngest, they leave the circle. People say that maybe it was just because the custom at the time was to follow those elders, so take the cue of the elders. But perhaps it was because also those older had a little more wisdom to know, gosh, I am a sinner. I'm not hanging around for Jesus to out me. Some people thought that he was writing out different sins in the sand. And so they were actually seeing, oh my gosh, I've done that, I've done that. This is all in the law. I'm a lawbreaker. I better get out of here. Again, speculation, but there's this clip of a Jesus film I saw just kind of in preparation of this moment. And the only thing you hear in this clip is stones dropping. I love that. It's such a wonderfully audible reminder of people feeling and sensing the conviction of the Spirit, that they came with this posture to accuse and condemn, and they leave empty-handed and realize that they don't have that right and that they are humbled before the presence of God, just like this woman. Jesus is, in this moment, taking people away from the judgment seat and giving it back to himself and saying, let God be God. God is the one who judges, not you. And I want to be clear here that Jesus is not just swiping and sweeping the sin underneath the rug. He believes in sin, and he doesn't condone it. I think that's why he says to the woman at the very end, don't leave your life of sin. He calls it a life of sin, what she's done. But the whole difference is the posture. These Pharisees and teachers of the law were right that it was sin. They were not in disagreement with Jesus about that. But their whole posture was so hypocritical, self-righteous, was so focused on the punishment and condemnation of that sin. And that is not the heart of Christ. There's nothing to suggest that Jesus doesn't identify the woman's actions as sin. But there's a whole lot to suggest that he has a completely different perspective than the teachers and the Pharisees in this moment. Even before blindingly obvious presenting sin, Jesus still sees and relates to a person. He has this magical, like, vision to be able to see past what is most obvious and visible to ourselves and to others. It's miraculous. This is the person whose fingers authored the very law that we all break all the time, and somehow he manages to see beyond our law-breaking. I remember when I was here in 2008, 2009, Nathan and I, we were in the New West. I don't know what we were doing in there at the time. I think maybe inviting people for some Christmas thing. And I remember sitting in the bar with Nathan. It sounds dodgier than it actually is. We weren't drinking, obviously, but we were sitting there, and there was a woman who was a street worker. And she came up to us and propositioned us. And somehow Nathan left me alone with her, as he's used to do. And so I had never been propositioned by anyone before. So that was a new experience. But also, after we told her that that wasn't going to happen and that was not why we were here and stuff, she still treated me and interacted with me as if I was one of her clients. Now, there was no sexual stuff happening, but the way she interacted with me was very physical. She was rubbing my hair and talking to me, and it was just like we were having this normal conversation, but that was the way she was. And so in my heart, I was feeling pretty uncomfortable because here we were talking about the weather or whatever it was, and she was like really very, very physical and affectionate with me. And in that moment, I did feel like God reminded me of the story where Jesus got anointed with the ointment of that woman who was known as a woman of the world. And, she's crying on his feet and rubbing his feet with her hair. She's very physical, right? And so people say, oh, that was the custom in the day. That was how these people would sort of seduce men. That was the way they interacted. So why did Jesus say, what are you doing? Like, treat me differently than that. He received the way she was. And in that moment there, I felt like it was important for me to just sit there and receive what she was giving. Not to see it as this is a prostitute offering, her sexual kind of foreplay stuff, but just to know that, like, she hasn't learned how to interact with people in a healthy way. This is all she knows, and she's not propositioning me. She knows now that I'm not there for anything, and I just sat there and received it. Now, mind you, if something had gone a little overboard, I would have not just sat there and received it, right? But just the physicality and how affectionate she was with me, I thought, God, help me see in this moment that she's not just a street worker. Help me see that she's your daughter. And let me receive the love that she's offering and the connection and friendship she's offering, regardless of whether it comes sometimes in the package of something else. That was a very profound moment for me. And I never understood that story in the Gospel of Jesus. I never understood what a scandal it was and how uncomfortable it might have been for those around till that moment. But it was a very, very good lesson for me to realize what is most visible and obvious and presenting is not necessarily the thing that Christ focuses on. And you see that all through the scriptures, all through the gospels, everybody is calling these people tax collectors and sinners, and Jesus is hanging out with them. It's amazing. A Augustine says, in this moment here, when the people drop their stones, so to speak, and leave the circle, he says, there are two left, but two left, misery and mercy. And I think in the Latin, it's miseria et misericordia. Mercy and misery are left alone together. And sometimes people might think, oh, that is a frightful thing. To be left alone with God is the worst thing. I'm going to be put to shame. I'm going to be condemned. I'm going to be destroyed. But actually, the complete opposite happens in this moment. When we leave people with Jesus, life happens. It's sometimes great to leave people with Jesus. Sometimes the whole business of religious people and faith and the church has not been life-giving to people. Sometimes we haven't been life-giving to people. And in verse 10, you know, this story in some ways is about this woman caught in adultery. In verse 10, 10 verses later, after we meet this woman, is the first time anyone in the story has talked to her directly. So far, we've only had indirect characterization about this woman. All we know about her is that she was caught in the act of adultery. And, you know, I was reading this yesterday, and, you know, sometimes in the scriptures, people will say woman this or woman that, and sometimes in our modern, to our modern day ears, it can sound a bit pejorative that people just refer to others as, oh, man or son or woman like that without a name. But yesterday I felt very touched by the way Jesus interacts with this lady. He says, woman, where are they? And I think it reminds her and reminds us that she is a woman, not just an adulterer. It's so easy in the story to only think of her as an adulterer, because that's what she was caught in. That's the biggest, most obvious presenting fact, and it was a fact, about her. And all of a sudden, it's like Jesus pulls out like this anchor, this rusty anchor. Did you forget that you're a woman? Did you forget that you're a person and even a daughter of mine? You're not just an adulterer, though this is what these people labeled you as, and only as. You are a person. I actually really love that moment. And he speaks to her. It's so easy sometimes to speak about people who have sinned, who have broken the law, to talk about how terrible they were. How many of us actually speak to those people, have the guts to do that? And how many of us actually have the guts to be Christ-like to those people? It's a powerful thing Jesus does. And it would have been a scandal, actually, in the moment, because in that time, men and women did not associate unless you were married. It was pretty scandalous. And on top of that, she was very obviously a sinner, who everybody in the whole sphere of that moment would have known. And Jesus is talking with her, and he's somehow not afraid that talking with her is going to contaminate him. Woman, where are those people who have condemned you? His words are not accusing. They're hardly even about the most presenting obvious thing. He's asking, where are the people who condemned you? It's not even directly, why did you do that, or anything like that. In the context of sin, Jesus' focus is on mercy and forgiveness. And in fact, in the context of sin, the light of Christ's mercy shines the brightest. Neither do I condemn you, he says. This is, remember, the God whose finger is inscribed on the Ten Commandments, you shall not commit adultery. And now in this moment, showing grace and mercy and forgiveness, his highest priority was not punishment and condemnation, but salvation. God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him, John 3:17. On another occasion, when Jesus is having dinner at Matthew's house, Many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And listen to this amazing thing he says. Jesus says, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. Now you go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I desire mercy." When I read this, I think, where can I go to show the mercy of God? I desire mercy. I look for opportunities to pour out mercy. That is Jesus' priority. If the Pharisees and teachers of the law are at the door of scandal, Jesus is looking for occasions to pour out mercy. Are we like that? When we hear somebody had a big blowout or, you know, somebody did something terrible, are we the first to call them, the first to see them and speak about mercy? I'm not. This convicts me. And I think it rightly would have convicted the Pharisees and teachers of the law that although they might have thought that they were in the heart of God, they were in fact very far away from it. And the last thing that I'll finish with this is kindness. My wife and I, we were talking yesterday about why she came to faith. The Ehlers were very influential in that many, many years ago. And a big part of it was kindness. The kindness of God expressed through his people. In this moment, Jesus is kind to this woman. Can you imagine what would have been going through her mind? First of all, she was caught in the act. Oh my goodness, that is frightful. It's one thing to do it. It's another thing to be caught doing it. It's another thing still to be brought and publicly be announced as having done it. And this whole thing is playing out. She's just a silent victim, basically. I know victim is a weird word to use, but she's at least a victim of these Pharisees and teachers kind of pushing her up against the wall in accusation. She's not a victim necessarily in the adultery, but what would have been going through her mind as they're clamoring for the stoning? And then as Jesus says, "Let him who's without sin cast the first stone," everyone leaves. Maybe she thought, "Oh gosh, Jesus is going to stone me now." And he springs up and he looks at her, and his words are, "Woman, woman, where are they? I'm not condemning you." That moment will forever be written in her mind. Do you think she would ever have forgotten that moment? It literally saved her life. The kindness of God literally saved her life. She would never have forgotten that. And you know what's amazing is that somehow Jesus seems to expect that the kindness he showed to her would have been sufficient motivation so that she would never have to do what she did again. That's all he says to her was, "I don't condemn you. Go and leave your life in sin." Apparently he thought that that interaction was sufficient motivation for her to leave her life of sin. Can kindness and mercy really be motivation enough for change and transformation? I think so. In Romans 2, it says that the kindness of God is what leads us to repentance. The Pharisees brought the severity and condemnation and punishment of God. And it's not that we don't believe in that. That was poured out in dramatic effect on Jesus. So that the kindness and mercy of God would flow towards us, so that we would repent. So in conclusion here, Jesus has an inherent magnetism and attraction about him. He lives to serve and invest his life in building up others. He doesn't show favorites and isn't party to one group, especially to Christians, claiming they're more righteous than others. All of us are equally in need of grace. He does hold us accountable for sin, as he solely has the right to judge and condemn. But he always sees our personhood despite our biggest failures. He loves sin because it's an opportunity for him to shower down his mercy and forgiveness and grace. And he's filled with kindness. And it's this kindness that can lead us to change our lives and follow a different way. And how about us? Do we know him this way? Are we bringing people to him in this way? And are we speaking of and demonstrating him in this world this way? So I think what we're to do is actually this moment where Jesus' words of any of you without the first sin can cast the first stone, and the sort of reflective moment that happens as a result of that as people begin to draw away. So I feel like I think God would have us do that reflection. Jesus, we've heard your words this morning, and we see things about you that remind us of why we were so attracted to you, drawn to you. So we invite your Holy Spirit now to speak to us. Where have we missed you? And where have we missed showing you as you are to others? So fill us with your spirit, your personality, your character, that we would represent you very well in this world. So that people would not only love you and like who you are, but be so proud to be associated in your family and in your community.
I actually feel like this morning there's an invitation to receive mercy, because before any of us can extend the mercy of God, we all have to walk the road of receiving it. Because we don't give what we haven't received ourselves. And so we're all identified with the one in this world.